Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
One other party is in this conference.
Alright then, first order of business is to say that this will be the last of these dial-in shows for a while. You see, I've got a lot going on in the next couple of weeks. So this coming Friday, I have a funeral to attend. And then after that, Tuesday, is the day when I travel to the World Science Fiction Convention in Washington, D.C. And, of course, Friday will be taken up. I will be at the convention, and I will probably not dial in for a show. It's greatly to be regretted, I think. Maybe I'm alone in that. But I think that the convention organizers did not choose to approve my plan to do a live reading at the convention. At least I assume they didn't approve it because I never heard anything back from them. Anyway, and then the succeeding Tuesday I'm going to be traveling again. So, either I've got pre-recorded shows going, or I've got a repeat for this coming Friday, and then the succeeding Tuesday, and then almost certainly the succeeding Friday, and then the Tuesday after that. Now, what else can I say about that? But I should, however, be able to dial in and do a live step farther out on the Saturdays. There's no clear obstacle to doing that. But yes, so I will be in Washington, D.C. From the 15th to the 20th. On the 20th, I'll be visiting the National Air and Space Museum, actually. At least that is my plan. Now, where was I last time? Well, last time I had just barely not finished reading a piece by I.I. Rabi from the proceedings of the Fourth Geneva Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy, 1971. And it had a bit of a depressive tone, to be very honest. If I'm not mistaken, which I could well be at this hour. I'm not totally awake. I take a long time to spool up in the morning, and it is morning where I am. If I'm not mistaken, I believe I Robbie died by suicide. So I don't know if that should be taken into account when considering the somewhat depressive nature of some of his remarks. But anyway, I will finish that. I will definitely finish that right now so that you can hear his conclusion. And then the question is, do I want to get into something else from that same volume? Or do I just want to read you some articles from the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority's monthly magazine Atom from the late 60s, early 70s, from that same period when people were still, you know, optimistic, at least some people were still, at least somewhat optimistic, that nuclear energy would be allowed to serve the energy needs of the world. So yes, going back to I.I. Robbie and his opening address at the Fourth Geneva Conference. It certainly has not escaped the notice of this intelligent audience that I have so far failed to mention the most immediate danger of all, nuclear warfare. This senseless threat to human culture, and indeed to human survival, has no precedent in history. Surely there is no ideal or pretended goal of any nation which is high enough to endanger the very existence of all humanity for its achievement. Perhaps Hitler, in his maddest last moments, wished to bring down all of humanity in his defeat, but for responsible statesmen otherwise sane to play such a role is to me and many of my fellow scientists incomprehensible. Perhaps the situation can be attributed to an overemphasis on local and tribal history, which has been the basic tradition of the past, and a failure to appreciate the sacred meaning of mankind as a whole. Most unfortunately, there is a lack of political invention which would create political means for statesmen to act rationally when it comes to controlling these vast dangers inherent in our developing science and technology. Thus far, we have dealt with science in reference to its practical applications in the technologies of industry, agriculture, health, communication, etc. Important as these are, both in benefit and danger to mankind, they represent only the externals of human life, the problems of health, comfort, and life support. However, the most important part of a person's life is within himself, and his deeper meaning and his relation to fellow men, to life itself and the universe outside himself. Self-understanding and self-realization in this context are the basic ends which humans need to satisfy. As the poets have reiterated through generations, each man is alone and basically afraid, alone in a universe into which he was born. The explorations of modern science connect mankind most directly with the universe as a whole. From the basic laws of physics, one can begin to understand the special properties of the various atomic species which make possible life itself, and the same basic laws extend universally from the most distant parts of space to the innermost fastnesses of matter of the infinitesimally small. The special properties of matter which make life possible turn out to be no accident, but rather a direct result of the most basic general laws of physics as manifested in quantum mechanics and relativity. From these studies, we learn that man is unique, and yet a part of the totality, subject to universal laws. It is part of the glory of the race that these laws were discovered by mankind. It has been stated that the proper study of mankind is man, but we now see that this cannot be approached narrowly, but only through the whole, which is science, Mankind is the mind and the developing consciousness of the universe. We can hope that if, indeed, we survive into the future, that men will realize deeply that their most noble goal is to understand themselves within the universe, and that this goal will override all the petty and parochial aims that so disturb the peace and endanger mankind's future existence. Thank you, Dr. Robbie. Okay, so how about those messages from heads of state and government, and specifically, yes. Message from Mr. Richard Nixon, the President of the United States of America. My warmest greetings to all who are attending the Fourth International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy in Geneva. It is difficult to believe that 16 years have passed since the first of these conferences in 1955. I was serving as vice president at that time, and I remember well the strong, favorable reaction in all parts of the world when President Eisenhower first suggested that such a conference be brought together. And I recall, too, the challenge which President Eisenhower presented in his message to that first conference when he declared that the atom must become man's obedient and tireless servant. Since that time, there have been tremendous strides in the effort to make nuclear energy the servant of mankind. The International Atomic Energy Agency has played an increasingly important role in that process, and its work deserves the most generous commendation. The most important thing about this progress of the past is that it can serve as the foundation for even greater progress in the future. In the last few years, the human race has shared in a remarkable new experience, the ability to look upon our planet as it appears from outer space. In that act, we have gained a new appreciation both of the beauty of our Earth and of its fragility. We have been reminded of the artificiality of political boundaries and of the obligation we all share to reach across such boundaries for the sake of improving our common home. At a time when the limits of many natural resources are becoming much more apparent, our capacity to manage resources and to find alternatives where necessary is becoming even more acute. It is here one of the most important benefits of nuclear energy can be realized. This fact was emphasized in my recent message to the United States Congress concerning our domestic energy program, and I would underscore this point again in addressing this distinguished international group. I extend my very best wishes for a most productive conference. Message from Mr. A.N. Kosygin, Chairman of the Council of Ministers of the USSR. On behalf of the Soviet government, I extend greetings to all those attending the Fourth International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. 16 years have passed since the first Geneva Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy, when scientists and experts from different countries met together for the first time on a broad international basis to discuss peaceful ways of utilizing atoms for the good of mankind. Over this relatively short period, considerable headway has been made in this new branch of science and technology. From the stage of scientific research and development in the 1950s, atomic energy has moved on to a time when it is being used on a wide scale in a number of countries and in the most varied areas of human endeavor. The ever more closely merging efforts of men of science in different lands will undoubtedly promote the will undoubtedly promote the rapid solution of the most important problems involved in the peaceful utilization of atomic energy, especially those associated with meeting man's continuously growing energy requirements. The Soviet Union, which has made great advances in the practical application of nuclear energy, stands resolutely in favor of the kind of international cooperation in Atoms for Peace which fully accords with the purposes and principles of the United Nations Charter, the Statute of the International Atomic Energy Agency, actually it just says International Energy Agency, but I think that's just a typographical error, and the provisions of the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. It must not be forgotten that there are also non-peaceful areas in which atomic energy is used, and that from the standpoint of preserving peace, they exert a serious and hazardous effect on the overall political climate, and more particularly on the opportunities for a broader development of peaceful cooperation. This is why the Soviet Union is consistently campaigning for settlement of the problems of nuclear disarmament as a whole, and for the adoption of specific measures that will gradually lead to that end. We attach great importance to the implementation of the Soviet Union's proposals relating to measures for achieving both nuclear disarmament and general and complete disarmament. The Soviet government is firmly convinced that the Fourth Geneva Conference, with its theme of benefits for mankind from the peaceful uses of atomic energy, will help to expand international cooperation on the scientific and technical plane. Allow me to wish all those taking part in the conference further success in the peaceful use of atomic energy in the interests of the whole of mankind. Now, thank you, Mr. Kosygin. Now, there's an invited paper on world energy requirements and resources in the year 2000. You know, and also a paper, Resources of Primary Energy. Let me flip to that and see what it actually is. Well, here's the abstract. The word is printed right there. Resources of Primary Energy, H. Mandel, Rhenish Westfälisches Elektrizitätswerk, Essen, Federal Republic of Germany. So Essen means eating in German, and it's proverbially such an ugly city that people say, if that's eating, I don't want to see vomiting. Just in case you ever wondered. But resources of primary energy. The problem of the long-term primary energy supply is extremely complex. It involves three main questions. One, whether the required quantity of a certain kind of primary energy be made available at a given time and within a given area. Two, would the quantity of primary energy meet competitive requirements? And three, whether the total supplies for primary energy requirements are guaranteed for centuries on a worldwide basis. The interdependency of these three questions is evident. The annual consumption of energy to be apportioned to a given kind of primary energy, and thus also the annual production of this primary energy, depend on numerous factors which, on their part, are interrelated. The usable regenerative sources of the world's energy are about 0.06 times 10 to the 18th power kilocalories per year. Although they could, in principle, meet about a quarter of the world's energy requirements by about the year 2000, they can be utilized to a limited extent only in the modern economy. Fossil fuels amount to about 28 times 10 to the 18th power kilocalories. If it is assumed that the atmosphere's oxygen is a derivative of the photosynthesis of the chlorophyll, and that about 1% of the presumed overall reserves of fossil fuels can be gained economically. The usable basic materials for nuclear fission represent energy reserves of around 1.5 times 10 to the 21st power kilocalories. At present, it is not possible to say anything definite about nuclear fusion, except that, judged by human standards, it is inexhaustible. Taking the present requirements as a basis, even fossil fuels would be sufficient for about 460 years, and the basic materials for nuclear fission for even 25,000 years. This consideration, however, leads to false conclusions. It is necessary to consider the world's population growth as well as the increasing per capita consumption. The result is that the reserves of fossil fuels would, for example, be sufficient up to only towards the end of the 21st century, whereas nuclear fuels would suffice for about 300 years. Thus, on the one hand, the world would be dependent upon nuclear fusion in the long term, and on the other hand, sufficient time remains to develop it. Now, this leads to significant panel discussion. So I may read the panel discussion in which Weinberg and our present author sort of get into it over the question of seawater, uranium, and so on. The thing being that, interestingly enough, the ability to extract uranium from seawater is not limited by the amount of uranium that's in seawater. I know that sounds really, really strange, but the fact is that it's limited by the concentration of uranium in seawater. And uranium is actually being added to the sea by erosion from the continents all the time, which has the interesting result that, to the best of our scientific knowledge, the sea is actually saturated with uranium. In other words, it contains as much uranium as it can hold. And so if you take uranium out of it, you'd have to take it out at a much higher rate than it's being put in order to reduce the concentration, because sea bottom sediments, for example, might redissolve uranium out into the ocean. Anyway, it's extraordinarily unlikely that we would ever consume uranium at such a rate as to make that a consideration. So for all intents and purposes, the sea could be considered an inexhaustible reservoir of the stuff, which is an intriguing concept. Anyway, back to the paper. If we define energy as the If we define energy as the capability for work, we indicate directly the key role that energy plays for the future of mankind. More and more work of a higher quality and a more versatile nature will be needed by mankind, whose working capacity and ability are being increasingly concentrated on mental activities. The natural resources of energy are referred to as primary energy resources. They are utilized in generally after several conversion processes involving conversion losses, in the form of useful energy or of chemical raw material. Figure 1 surveys the different kinds of primary energy and their conversion processes as far as they are today or will be in the future of practical importance. One should note, as far as the final form of energy is concerned, a trend towards a preference for electricity as the most versatile and valuable form of energy. In the Federal Republic of Germany, by the year 2000, approximately 50% of the overall energy demand may be met by electricity. There's a Woody Guthrie line, "I don't like dictators none, but I think this whole country should be run by electricity." The problem of the long-term supply of primary energy is extremely complex. It involves three main questions. 1. Is it possible to provide at a given time and in a certain geographical area the required amount of work from a definite primary energy? 2. Does this primary energy meet the requirement of competitive ability? 3. Can the overall demand for primary energy be met in future centuries? The interdependence between these three problems is obvious. See Figure 2. The annual consumption of energy from a given primary energy, and thus the annual output of this primary energy, depend essentially on the following factors, which are also interrelated: quantities of reserves with a certain time-dependent structure of output costs, price of the primary energy, costs of conversion into the final and or effective energy form, and price and effect of substituting other primary energies. This will become still more complicated as different energy forms are produced jointly or together with chemical products. In the following, simple outlines of the problem as concern the Federal Republic of Germany are given. The first relates to the reserves of primary energy and to their geographic distribution. since imports for the consumption of primary energy amounted in the Federal Republic of Germany to 44.5% of the total requirements in 1969. And this fraction may rise to 80% by 2000. It is necessary to examine worldwide conditions. Fundamental mistakes are often made when assessing the reserves of primary energies. Either no distinction is made between the established reserves on the one hand and the probable additional reserves on the other, or the statistics only consider the established reserves. Often, the limits of the output costs up to which the reserves are counted are not indicated. By established reserves, we understand those known deposits whose primary energy contents have been established to the extent that production by modern methods is possible within determined costs. By the probable additional reserves is meant those deposits of primary energy which lie in extensions of known deposits or which are not yet explored, but it is known or presumed that they contain the primary energy in question, this presumption being based on extrapolation or preliminary indications. Economic reasons generally prevent extensive exploration and exploitation of deposits which are ahead of the demand by more than 1 to 2 decades. That's an important consideration because you get people saying, well, the world only has 20 years' supply of X. Well, in many cases, 20 years ahead is basically where the people who, you know, do mining and extractive industries in general want to be. And so it's easy to misinterpret the statements that they make. All right, figures 1 and 2 are some interesting diagrams. Showing basically where energy comes from, how it gets to where it's going, and where it goes. Figures 3 and 4 survey the world's primary energy resources as far as they can be derived from available data. They are chiefly based on data compiled for the World Energy Conference 1968 and on later corrections. In these figures, we have used 10 to the 15th power kilocalories as a uniform unit. The unit Q equals 10 to the 18th power BTU, used in the Anglo-Saxon countries for similar studies, corresponds to 250 times 10 to the 15th kilocalories. To give an idea of the amounts of energy of 10 to the 15th kcal, it would represent the present half-yearly consumption of primary energy in the Federal Republic of Germany. If one starts from the hypothesis that all the world's fossil fuels can be traced back to chlorophyll, and that the oxygen of our atmosphere is a product of the photosynthesis of chlorophyll, the total deposits of fossil fuels would amount to approximately 2.5 times 10 to the 21st power kilocalories. Figure 3 shows that the established and the probable additional deposits, which, on the basis of present knowledge, could be economically exploited, amount to approximately 9 to 22 times 10 to the 18th kilocalories. Therefore, approximately 0.5 to 1% of the total presumably existing reserves of fossil fuel have been traced. The factor 100 is, of course, an important uncertainty for any long-term forecast. For example, should it be possible to exploit economically 10% of the total contents of the world's fossil energies, the available quantities of energy compared with the values shown in Figure 3 would increase by 10 to 20 times. These comments clearly show that the price of the primary energy at the place of consumption is of much greater importance than the total energy resources of the world. The latter gives practically no indication as far as the possible contribution of a particular primary energy to meeting energy requirements is concerned. Failing to recognize this fact often leads to misjudgments of the security of supply. Interesting method of calculation. He essentially figures, you know, you take the carbon, assume that all the oxygen in the atmosphere comes from photosynthesis, take the carbon that would have been produced, and assume it all exists somewhere in the form of coal. I think, however, that that may be wrong because I think that early photosynthesis, a great deal of its products may be locked up in carbonates, such as limestone. So that may be an error. Figure 4 shows the geographic distribution of the world's fossil fuel energy resources according to what we know at present. We may expect some changes of their distribution, which, however, from the overall point of view, are likely to be of only local and temporary interest. The world energy potential from fossil fuels can at present be broken down as follows. Approximately 70% hard coal, 6% brown coal, 4% peat, 5% oil, 7% oil shale and oil sand, and 8% natural gas. One wonders why Germany shut down its hard coal mines but is still burning lignite. The mind boggles. The energy potential of nuclear fissile energy amounts to at least 3.5 times the established and the probable additional deposits of fossil energy resources, considering only those deposits which are exploitable at costs not exceeding $30 per pound U308. See figures 5 and 6. If higher cost categories and possible uranium extraction from seawater are included, the reserves of the economically exploitable nuclear primary energies would amount to approximately 70 times the reserve of fossil energies. This statement is based on the assumption that only 1% of the 5,000 times 10 to the 6 power tons of uranium carbonate contained in seawater and only 1/3 part per million of the 10 to the 14th power tons of uranium contained in the Earth's granites and basalts can be economically extracted. See Figure 7. As with fossil energies, there is also an uncertainty in the forecasts. Nuclear energy resources of much higher price will prove to be economical because, after the introduction of breeder reactors, the costs of fissile material will have only a minor influence on the production costs of energy. It must be emphasized that Figure 5 does not include the nuclear reserves of the People's Republic of China or those of the USSR, as no data were available. It is likely that these countries have large deposits at their disposal. When assessing the deposits, it must be borne in mind that further deposits of primary energy will be found and that some may shift from their original price category to lower ones because of technical progress in extraction and treatment. Moreover, deposits of primary energy under the oceans have hardly been explored. You can drill for oil or gas under the oceans, but you certainly would have a hard time mining for coal down there. To complete the picture of the energy resources, we must refer to the world's regenerative energy resources. In former centuries, these constituted the only energy supply basis, but declined in importance in proportion to the increase in the demand for primary energy. As a rough assessment, the economically usable quota of the regenerative energy resources are of the order of approximately 60 times 10 to the 15th power kilocalories per year, of which 70% are attributable to wood and agricultural refuse, more than 15% to solar energy, and 10% to hydroelectric power. The latter occupies an exceptional position since it can be converted into valuable energy with an efficiency of more than 90%. The regenerative resources of primary energy could cover approximately 1/4 of the world's energy demand by the year 2000. However, it is unlikely that they will be used on that scale, mainly because they are increasingly supplemented, even in developing countries, by the more convenient and economic non-regenerative primary energies. It is relevant to examine the history of the use of energy. Table 1 shows that throughout history until 1970, the regenerative sources of primary energy dominated. Until 1870, the regenerative sources of primary energy dominated. Then this leading role was assumed by the non-regenerative fossil fuels. Because of technological progress, the scale of the usable forms of energy will be progressively extended. The new energy forms are distinguished in particular by an initially high growth rate. Thus, we observe a continuous structural change. For instance, since 1910, this change has been characterized by a proportional increase in the quota of oil and natural gas at the expense of coal, whereas energies from wood, peat, and vegetal refuse have decreased considerably in their percentages. Since 1960, in the era of fossil fuels, the Federal Republic of Germany has undergone a shift towards a greater utilization of liquid and gaseous fuels, an increased use that is due to their economic superiority over solid fuels. They are preferred, although their energy potential is only approximately 16% that of solid fuels. It was certainly incorrect if, in the past, an imminent depletion of the deposits of liquid and gaseous fuels was repeatedly predicted. However, it is obvious that a consumption rate of now 3% and perhaps 5% by the year 2000, these resources are tending to deplete more rapidly than coal, whose consumption rate is at present only approximately 7%. Therefore, it cannot be excluded that one day we shall have to produce liquid and gaseous fuels from solid ones in order to meet the requirements in those areas where they cannot be substituted. This trend towards an increasing percentage in the use of oil and natural gas will presumably last until the 80s, after which the influence of nuclear energy, which will increase even more rapidly, will become more established, and the portion of use of oil and natural gas will decrease. Finally, nuclear energy will take the lead by the year 2000. Whether at a given moment and in a given geographic area, the required quantities of a certain primary energy will be available is implicit in the question concerning the security of supply for the particular area. This is particularly important as the geographic distribution of energy. As the geographic distribution of primary energy deposits does not correspond to the distribution of consumption. Therefore, the security of supply of a nation with a passive trade balance can only be guaranteed by a mixture of primary energies of different kinds and geographic origins. In the Federal Republic of Germany, too, the domestic primary energy production cannot secure the supply of energy in the long run. It cannot even act as a price regulator. By 2000, our demand for primary energy will amount to at least 840 times 10 to the 6th power tons of coal equivalent. The present, still relatively high domestic production amounts to about 170 times 10 to the exponent omitted TCE. In the long run, nuclear fuels will greatly strengthen the security of supply, particularly in the next century when the reserves of depleted uranium, by then accumulated in Germany, will constitute the main source of energy. For the time being, we do not need nuclear fusion to cover our energy demand. Its introduction might, however, solve the problem of securing the primary energy supply. By the way, nuclear energy will, in the long run, render the electric power supplies largely independent of fuel input costs, since the cost of depleted uranium, or those of heavy water in the case of fusion, will contribute only negligibly to the energy cost. The figures shown in the last two columns of Table 1 prove that in the foreseeable future we should fear no shortage of energy. Therefore, the choice of the primary energies will be basically determined by economic considerations and not by the security of supply of different primary energies. This applies even more in the coming decades than to the present. There may be some exceptions in those applications where, for technical reasons, we cannot change to other energies, for example, at present in parts of the transport sectors. I'm not sure that sounded nearly as smart after the 1973-74 oil price shocks, the Arab oil embargoes and that kind of thing. The competitiveness of primary energies is determined by their price, free to the consumer, and by the cost for their conversion into the form of effective energy. Therefore, different prices of primary energies apply to different applications. The production costs of primary energies consist of the cost of exploration, opening up and developing the deposits, and extraction. To this must be added the cost of converting the primary energy into a transportable form, or the product that can be fed into the energy conversion plants. The price free to the consumer is determined not only by the conversion costs, but also by transport and some ancillary costs such as taxes and other charges. Some cost factors are determined by geology, some by technology, and some by politics. Besides, the competitive situation exerts a regulative influence. Some energies, such as oil and natural gas, show a high degree of flexibility regarding pricing and thus exert a strong substitution effect over other energies. Generally, the higher its labor costs, the more an energy source is threatened by competition. Figure 8 surveys the wage share of the different primary energies free to the consumer. Depending on the location and conditions of the deposits, this share may differ very greatly, as shown by the example of hard coal, where in the figure it varies roughly between 25 and 50% labor cost. In the light of ever-increasing wages, it will, for the different primary energies, be all the more difficult to counteract price increases by technological progress the higher the wage share. Also, on account of the long-term development of other cost factors, an increase in the prices of classical primary energies may be expected. Nuclear energy has an obvious advantage, since the percentage of the uranium concentrate of the end energy costs is extremely low. This is shown very clearly by Figure 9. It also indicates the share of the fuel stocks in capital requirements, the calculations being based on stocks of 1 month for the classical energy hard coal and of 3 months for oil. In spite of the high capital tied up in the initial fuel inventory of the nuclear fission reactors, their energy-generating costs are much lower than those of the classical power stations. The higher capital demand for the initial fuel inventory of the fast breeders is attributable to the physics. In the long run, nuclear energy will exert the strongest substitution effect on other energies, especially as it will enter the electricity sector, for which, as already mentioned, in the highly industrialized countries, by the year 2000, approximately 50% of the primary energy demand will be required. Nuclear energy, therefore, might in future be the most important regulative and stabilizing factor for energy prices. Other energy prices will, as far as they may be sufficiently flexible, adapt themselves to nuclear energy. Oil, for instance, still has considerable margin in view of the taxes and other charges. In the Federal Republic of Germany, part of the market for other primary energies will decline rapidly in its absolute values and be even more expressed as a percentage, since not only less capacity of energy conversion plants, for instance, power plants, will be installed, but also since existing plants will be operated for fewer hours. For the destiny of mankind, the question of meeting energy requirements is extremely important, but this question is only significant if considered on a worldwide scale and therefore can only be dealt with universally. In relation to the present world energy consumption of 60 times 10 to the 15th power kilocalories, the reserves of the fossil fuels, see Figure 3, would only last for 150 to 370 years when the energy from nuclear fission is included. I'm sorry, that's a semicolon. When the energy from nuclear fission is included, we obtain a possible utilization period of approximately 25,000 years. These estimates are based on very conservative assumptions concerning the possible energy reserves. Such an approach, however, leads to false conclusions, as it considers neither the world population increase nor the ever-increasing per capita consumption of energy. While the world population increased very slowly since the pre-Christian era until about 1650, from then onwards a more rapid growth took place that has become a, quote, population explosion since about 1950. The growth rate rose to approximately 30% every 10 years, which is about 100 times higher than in the first millennium AD. The world population is now approximately 3,500 million and might rise by 2000 to approximately 6,000 million, even if, in future, there would be a heavy decline of the world population growth rate, owing to worldwide family planning. It is probably no exaggeration to state that the increase will reach 20,000 million people by the end of the 21st century. Simultaneously with the growth of world population, however, an increase in the per capita consumption of primary energy will take place in order to secure adequate nutrition and accommodation and to allow people gradually to share in the progress of civilization. During the last 70 years, the average utilization factor of the primary energy could be increased from 11.5 to 30%. This dampened the growth of the per capita consumption of primary energy. A further improvement in the efficiency will, however, be very limited by physical conditions, as well as by the possibilities of technical and economic realization. Therefore, almost constant growth rates of the specific consumption of primary energy are to be expected provisionally. The forecasts concerning the development of the per capita consumption can, in the long run, be oriented toward those of the United States of America, where the per capita consumption of energy in 1970 was approximately 73 gigacalories per year. Compared with our development of consumption, this indicates a development lead of approximately 17 years, and if compared with the overall world consumption, a lead of more than 50 years. The average world per capita consumption of primary energy is now approximately 17 gigacalories per year. Let us assume arbitrarily, for the whole world, saturation point 3 times higher than the present consumption in the USA. That is approximately 200 gigacalories per year, person per year. The Federal Power Commission of the USA expects that by only the end of this century, the per capita consumption of electricity in the USA will rise from the present 6,000 kilowatt hours per year to approximately 28,000 kilowatt hours per year, whereas the electricity will possibly cover only 45% of the energy demand. Actually, it's about half of that right now, about 14,000. This would mean that by the year 2000 in the USA, the specific energy consumption would already amount to approximately 150 gigacalories per person per year. Therefore, it seems realistic to assume that in the long run, the world consumption will amount to 200 gigacalories per person per year. Such long-term forecasts are, of course, always problematic. It is, for instance, conceivable that the trend towards consumption may decrease for the benefit of other aims because of the way of life of mankind. Because the way of life of mankind could change radically. If, however, we assume a continuous development of the present worldwide situation. No. If, however, we assume a continuous development of the present worldwide situation and that it will be free of catastrophes, the population growth and even more the increase in the per capita consumption would, according to what has just been said, lead to annual primary energy demands in the next 100 to 200 years, which would set quite different standards for the use of our energy reserves. An annual demand of primary energy of 20,000 million inhabitants times 200 gigacalories per person per year equals 4 times 10 to the 18th power kilocalories per year, would mean that reserves of fossil primary energies of around 10 to the 19th power kilocalories, which might possibly still exist by the year 2100, would meet the requirements of only 3 more years, and that the average reserves for nuclear fission would be sufficient for 300 years, even if they could be used to 85%. The conclusions concerning the fossil fuels would not change very much, even allowing for an error of a factor of 10 when assessing the reserves. Such an enormous consumption of energy, which is finally converted into heat, might even influence the thermal economy of the Earth. We must bear in mind that 4 times 10 to the 18th power kilocalories per year corresponds to roughly 3% of the thermal energy yielded by the sun to the land masses of the globe. The increase in the CO2 content in the atmosphere could have a great impact on the climate should there be a large-scale exploitation of fossil fuels. A study of this problem for the future seems to be not only interesting, but necessary. The above comments show that the fossil energy resources will not meet the requirements of world energy supplies if considered on a century timescale. Nuclear fission, however, could cover this demand for several centuries. This means that we have ample time to develop, economically and technologically, the most important resource of our energy, namely controlled nuclear fusion. This problem will presumably be solved much earlier than necessary from the viewpoint of energy requirements. Nuclear fission also became feasible earlier than was necessary from the standpoint of the fossil energy reserves. Now, what can be said about the long-term aspects of energy supplies from nuclear fusion without indulging too much in speculation? The main problem for the technical realization of controlled nuclear fusion lies in maintaining the required high temperatures of the plasma, which reach, even in the case of the most favorable reaction, the deuterium-tritium reaction, around 50 times 10 to the 6th power kelvins. If we are able to control even higher temperatures, other substances, especially lithium, could be used directly to generate energy. Whereas the ratio of deuterium to all hydrogen isotopes is 1 to 700 in water, tritium does not exist in nature. It can be produced, for example, by neutron irradiation of lithium-6 with an abundance of 7% in natural lithium. The concentration of deuterium in the seawater is roughly 10,000 times higher than that of uranium. This means that the possible production of energy from seawater, in the case of nuclear fusion, is 10 to the 4th power times higher than in the case of nuclear fission. An example may illustrate the potential of energy production by nuclear fusion of the deuterium content of the ocean. If all oceans consisted of oil, their combustion would yield only 1/66th of their fusion energy potential. If we succeeded in also using the lithium reaction, we could tap an additional resource whose yield would be higher than that of deuterium. This scale could be enlarged at will after achieving still higher reaction temperatures, so that nuclear fusion would in fact constitute a practically inexhaustible source of energy for mankind. In producing tritium or deuterium from seawater, we assumed that in both cases, in producing uranium or deuterium from seawater, we assumed that in both cases only 1% could be economically extracted. This results in an energy potential of roughly 10 to the 21st power kilocalories in the case of uranium fission, and roughly 10 to the 25th power kilocalories for nuclear fusion. Nothing certain can now be said about the cost of the energy generation by fusion reactors, since we do not even know how such a reactor will be conceived. It can be assumed that only fusion reactors with a power of several thousand megawatts will be economic. There are signs that their specific construction costs will be about those of fission reactors. The fuel costs from deuterium and tritium, however, might amount to only several hundredths of one pfennig. From this we may conclude that nuclear fusion will not supply us with cost-free electricity, as some may perhaps hope, but that there will be only fixed charges which will encourage extensive utilization of the power offered. It is important to note that, owing to their low variable costs, fusion reactors would depend to a still lesser degree on the fuel costs and their variations than nuclear fission reactors. In view of the expected relatively low electricity generating costs of future nuclear fission reactors, the fusion reactors will hardly make it possible to obtain important changes in prices. In the future, great efforts must be concentrated on reducing transport and distribution costs of energy in order to obtain low overall costs to the consumer. Though this study is hypothetical on many points, we may make the following conclusions. 1. The overall world energy resources can, if judged by human standards, be considered as being inexhaustible. This applies even in the light of the exponentially increasing energy consumption. 2. The problem of energy supplies, therefore, remains chiefly a problem of costs. Also, in the long run, the cost will be the determining factor for the choice and the extent of the utilization of different primary energies. 3. Fossil energies show, on the long-term basis, a tendency of increasing prices. Anyway, they alone could not meet the energy demand of the next century. 4. Nuclear fission energy, and probably later nuclear fusion, will become the main resources of secure and low-cost energy supplies. 5. The security of supply must at present be guaranteed by a mixture of different primary energies of various geographical origins. Nuclear energy should almost completely solve this problem. For the future of a nation, the two factors of energy and creative imagination will be much more important than its natural resources. So I'm just going to read discussion on agenda item 1.2. So paper by Sir John Hill, paper by Xavier Michon, no discussion. Let's see. El Tum Danso. Perhaps Mr. Petroschantz could say what percentage of the Soviet Union's electricity production is nuclear. A.M. Petroschantz. The proportion of nuclear power is still relatively small. The total capacity of all the nuclear power stations in the USSR at present amounts to 170 million kilowatts, and the nuclear capacity is about 2.5 million kilowatts. The point is that the USSR is well provided with energy resources. Nuclear power will be playing an important part by the end of the present century. Okay. Further discussion on another two papers. W. Lepecki. I should like to ask Mr. Hirai Zumi, what is the role of the heavy water reactor in the Japanese program, and what is the status of the heavy water prototype? T. Yamada. Perhaps I can answer this question. Light water reactors are preferred in Japan, and this situation will probably continue in the foreseeable future. However, from the standpoint of efficient utilization of nuclear fuels, light water reactors are not very satisfactory, and we opted for heavy water reactors with a view to achieving balance between economy and efficient fuel utilization. The prototype we are now constructing is a 160-megawatt heavy-water-moderated, light-water-cooled reactor, Fugen, and we are expecting it to go into operation in 1974-75. The Japanese heavy water reactors are unlike the CANDU BLWR and the SGHWR, but they also have significant differences as we intend to use plutonium fuel. In the late 70s, we expect that many heavy water reactors will be operating in the Japanese electricity network along with light water reactors. I would refer you to paper P/232 for further details. They didn't actually end up doing that. They built Fugen but didn't follow it up, probably because of plutonium utilization in light water reactors. N. Ibers, if I understand Mr. Marques de Souza, paper P/802, correctly, the Brazilians are hoping to develop a local fuel cycle industry covering all phases of the fuel cycle. Does this mean they will also take care of all phases of the enriched uranium fuel cycle? J. A. Marques de Souza, as regards the different phases of the fuel cycle in the Brazilian program, the situation is as follows. Prospecting and drilling, actively developed. Mining and yellowcake production, commercial contract underway for installations. Uranium purification and UO2 pellet production, pilot plants in operation designed and built in our own country. Fuel element fabrication and reprocessing, laboratory studies, see paper P/197. Uranium enrichment, techno-economical and feasibility studies. Let's see. A.M. Weinberg, I should like to comment briefly on paper P/359 by Mr. Mandel. Mr. Mandel's estimate of the
There are two other parties in this conference.
Okay, sorry about that. Not sure what happened there. I'm going to try and finish reading this discussion from Alvin Weinberg and Mr. Mandel of Germany. But I want to remind you, you're listening to Hear Now the Words on the Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System, and I look forward to receiving your cards and letters right to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. Now, where was I? A.M. Weinberg, I should like to comment briefly on paper P/359 by Mr. Mandel. Mr. Mandel's estimate of the energy content of the sea, assuming the DD reaction can eventually be mastered, is 9 times 10 to the 24th power kilocalories. That is about 5,000 times the energy content of the extractable uranium and thorium contained in the rocks of the Earth. These figures are not in line with similar estimates of our own, which show the two resources to be more nearly equal. Of course, if fusion always had to depend on the DT reaction with lithium as raw material, the balance would be different. The energy in uranium and thorium together is greater than that in lithium. H. Mandel, these long-term predictions constitute no more than a general assessment of the possibilities which would appear to exist in principle. Enormous research programs extending over long periods of time will be necessary, as we all know, before any of these possibilities can be realized in practice. For the moment, our estimates can well be made in orders of magnitude. Hence, I estimated the fusion energy potential of the deuterium in the seas on the basis of the average energy recovery from the two DD reactions. The result was a total potential of 9 times 10 to the 26th kcal. But no doubt, only part of the deuterium content of the seas will be economically extractable. I took that part to be 1%, and so arrived at the figure quoted in my paper, 9 times 10 to the 24th kcal, for the economically extractable energy potential of the deuterium contained in the seas. From Mr. Weinberg's comment, it is not clear, of course, whether the estimates to which he refers yielded different results on the basis of the same initial assumptions. What he does say is that the estimates have led to roughly equal values for the energy content of the seas and the energy content of the extractable uranium and thorium contained in the rocks of the Earth. I have not examined this last relationship. Rather, I have confined myself, for purposes of comparison, to the fission energy potential of the economically extractable uranium contained in the seas, assuming, as before in the case of deuterium, that only 1% could be extracted economically. Mr. Weinberg's comparison with the energy content of the uranium and thorium that can be extracted from the Earth's crust might well suggest misleading conclusions, because the extractable fraction of uranium and thorium in rock is not a quantity that can be assessed easily. If we assume that the extractable fractions are the same in every case, Mr. Weinberg's conclusion regarding the approximate equality of the energy potentials attributable to uranium and thorium fission and to deuterium fusion would be confirmed by my initial figures, too. But, in fact, the fraction of uranium and thorium that can be extracted economically from the Earth's crust is probably smaller by orders of magnitude.